Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back as we continue going through our 100 favorite movies of all time. Been a little bit of a hiatus, unintentionally. Almost 2 full weeks there in between one episode to the other. I just kind of ran out of time to watch Magnolia. Did not have enough time. As you can see, I moved, if you're watching this. And because of that, finding a 3-hour window in a brand new house when you're trying to set everything up and do everything was not easy to do. The Witch, piece of cake. Got that done like a week and a half ago. Magnolia, a little bit different of a story. So we're on to number 27, our 74th episode, talking about Magnolia from 1999 and The Witch, which John actually spelled properly, though I refuse to ever put two V's. It's a W as far as I'm concerned.
That's from, not what IMDb says. IMDb says it's two V's.
It literally is two V's, but I'm not calling it The Witch. So it's the way, like, you must now refer to it as The Witch all night. Otherwise, okay. It's just funny that they actually put that up there, because then also in Eggers' last movie, like, he has a bunch of weird stuff like that too. Like, he doesn't just like doing his, he doesn't like to just be normal, which I guess is a good thing in the long run, but still.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's Eggers. We let, you know what? He makes such good movies, we can let him get away with it.
Yeah. Well, the fun part here is, John, we normally start with what the most popular movie is. We're talking about two pretty unpopular movies here today. Eggers' first movie. Is this his first movie, or did he have like something random before this?
This was his first movie.
This was his first. I know sometimes like a director will be like, this is my first movie that went in the theaters, and then they had some random BS movie that John would sit here and tell me is like the most magnificent thing ever. But and then we have Magnolia from 99, which was Paul Thomas Anderson's follow-up to Boogie Nights. Boogie Nights, obviously, much more popular. And There Will Be Blood comes out a bunch of years later, and that's very popular. Magnolia, I think, is a classic, but it's also very hard to get people to sit down and watch because it's 3 hours long, and it's not a 3-hour epic. It is 3 hours of humans, which is always an interesting thing. So don't really have a go-to on this one, so I'm going to flip a coin, and by flip a coin, I mean we're going to talk about Magnolia first and then talk about The Witch, just because I decided that's the way I wanted to do it, and I feel like maybe we'll have a couple more Paul Thomas Anderson fans in here than, or a few less. I don't even know. It doesn't matter. Both of these movies.
Probably an equal amount at this point.
Yeah. And the fun thing, John, I don't know about you. Did you watch any other movies this week? Because I did not.
I did. I actually watched a few movies in this last 2 weeks.
Good. So we'll actually have something to talk about. I literally watched just these two movies over the last 2 weeks. So that should make this interesting. But anyway, Magnolia. So this is my number 27, very high up on my list. One of those movies that I probably saw for the first time around like 2010, 2011, right after high school, right into college, whatever. And it always stuck with me. Actually, the first time I ever saw this movie, it was on like Showtime or Encore or something like that. And I missed the first 15 minutes of the movie. It opened up where the magnolia flower is opening. And I was like, oh, good. I caught it right at the beginning, not realizing that there was a whole intro of Greenberry Hill and the scuba diver and the suicide. However, watched it, sat down, couldn't really believe what I was watching, went back, watched it again, watched it from the opening, couldn't really believe what I was watching. What was funny about this movie, though, is I don't know if Canada had this game, but did you ever have Seen It, John?
Yep.
You had Seen It. Okay. So in Seen It, you know, they would have like the video clips that you would play. And one of the video clips was actually the scene where it's raining frogs. It goes from the point where it starts raining frogs into the pool to when Julianne Moore's ambulance gets to the hospital on its side. And that's where the scene would end. And they would pop up with the question, what movie is this? Or how many frogs are there? Whatever it was.
Yeah.
And I remember always being like, what the hell is that movie? And then I sit down, I watch the movie, and I'm like, what the hell is this movie? However, I do really believe what puts this movie up at number 27, first of all, the scope is unbelievable. He wrote a novel and made it a 3-hour movie. I mean, that's essentially what this is. Like, it's, you know, he gets into everybody's brains. The acting is absolutely fantastic. Tom Cruise, with arguably the biggest robbery in Oscar history, won the Golden Globe, lost to Michael Caine because Michael Caine says something stupid the entire freaking movie. Go look up the Letterboxd number one review for whatever that movie is, Cider House Rules. It's hilarious, and it's exactly how I feel about that movie. But anyway, the acting's great. But for a 3-hour and 8-minute movie, the pacing is absolutely ridiculous. It never lets up, Every character gets their moments. You get to know all of them. Every scene is so interesting. And it's 3 hours and 8 minutes. I always pause it at the part with the worm, when the little kid raps about the worm. Because for me, I always like to kind of like pause it, take in that rap, because that rap is so integral to the movie. I'll get into the whole thing with Orlando Jones, which, John, I don't know how much you know about Orlando Jones in this movie, but that's definitely a conversation we need to have here because it's very interesting. But I always like to pause it there. And it always blows my mind that that's 42 minutes into the movie. Because in my estimation, that's 20 minutes in. Like, that, this movie just flies. This movie just absolutely flies. And my wife just texted me what the top Letterboxd review was. It's, I can't focus. But anyway, this movie just flies. Every storyline, it rips through. I love the Amy Mann soundtrack, Oh, For the Sake of Momentum, Wise Up, all those things. One, her cover of that is great. It just moves. And that's so hard to do. And yet I'm so invested in every character. They're all so unique. They all have their own stories. I remember one time I was speaking with somebody about this movie and they said they couldn't get behind it because two old men dying is too much. And I felt personally, because I can understand where that's coming from. It feels a little repetitious, maybe.
Yeah.
However, it is showing the person who didn't lose it all now having to come to terms with everything as they're finding out their mortality and going the downward spiral. And then we're getting the person who's getting almost redemption on their way out with their speech about regret and everything like that. So I think every character is unique. The acting is fantastic. The story is amazing. And yeah, I mean, I couldn't believe when I was watching it this time how much dialogue I knew in this movie, to the point where I'm actually kind of concerned that this and Fellowship of the Ring and The Deer Hunter might be the movies that I can quote the most, and they're all over 3 hours long, and that really bothers me. But anyway, John, I just spoke for 5 minutes. What did you think about your first experience with Magnolia?
One of the most interesting things about this movie is just how Paul Thomas Anderson is able to seamlessly switch between, I think we get, what, six consecutive storylines at the same time, mm-hmm. and just these, like, natural switches that he does between them with these characters. Like, this is something that could really lead to confusion a lot of the time, but he seamlessly transitions from one set of characters to the next in a way where it's like you could just follow along the story so well. And the perspectives of this, of the characters that we're like seeing this movie through, change so much. We don't spend a lot of time at any single moment with many characters until we get kind of towards the middle of the film, where we, and I really enjoy that that's how PTA does this as well, where he starts with like really short scenes of each character, and then they kind of grow in length the further we get into the middle, and then they kind of once again shrink towards the end. It has this like symmetrical style to it, which really just shows his mastery of film and his understanding of how an audience can understand what he's presenting.
Yeah, this, see, so I'm a big fan of these types of movies. I mean, I had Crash on my top 100 list. Like, I really love these multi-character stories, these almost like unfocused, whatever. Shortcuts is a great one by Robert Altman. I mean, Robert Altman was kind of, I don't know if he was the inventor of this genre, but he's the one that people mostly know for this genre. Nashville, Gosford Park, you know, and then he goes and makes The Long Goodbye, which is like a straightforward whatever. But he was known for just kind of all these characters who come together. Some are going to have through lines. Some aren't going to have through lines. But what I love about Magnolia that puts it above Crash and puts it above the Altman movies and things like that is that every character has their moment. Every character has a full arc. This movie takes place in one day. It's the morning to the night. That's it. And then the next morning when they wake up and, you know, the frogs have fallen. This is all in one day. And yet it never feels like, oh man, like how, like, oh, they're going to force this or coincidence or whatever. And I really do think that this was Paul Thomas Anderson's just reflection on coincidence and all these random things that happen in life that, you know, I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman's character in this movie cracks me up every time because you can clearly tell that it's just Paul Thomas Anderson writing, like, just fucking trust me. Like, please just trust me. That is what that character is. However, those are the things where like something will happen, something will happen, something will happen, something will happen. And all of a sudden you go, oh, that would only happen in a movie. Wow, that's so ridiculous. But then when we watch it in a movie, we don't tend to buy it. We can't just go with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I love about this movie is, like, you think about how every single character is actually connected, where you have John C. Reilly, who's probably on the furthest outside. He comes into Melora Waters. Melora Waters' father is the host of a show. That show is owned by Earl Partridge, whose son is Frank T.J. Mackey, who, and you just, you keep building it out and building it out. And you realize, like, there isn't coincidence in this stuff. Like, this is how, like, if you were a adult version of a child genius, you would still be feeling this. And we've heard these stories about the parents stealing the money and all of that. And then you would be watching that show just so happens to be on the same night that Stanley decides he's going to have his, I don't feel like doing this anymore. But why couldn't that happen? And I just think that it's such a deep exploration of coincidence and just what it means to be human. And that's what I love so much about this movie. Like, it is sloppy. It's a mess. This is not a tight, concise movie, but it is so purposefully sloppy because everything is sloppy. Life is sloppy, and these characters are meant to be a mess and whatever. But I could not agree with you more that what he's able to do at the beginning is, man, that opening speech by Frank T.J. Mackey, whew, if you're not in on what the hell is wrong with this character, I don't know. And then it goes from that speech. You think about how this opens, this movie. It starts with, first of all, these three stories that are absolutely out of nowhere, just to reveal coincidence, almost to set up the audience for, like, please just trust me. And then it goes into Frank T.J. Mackey, 1-800-TAME-HER. Okay. That ends with Officer Jim praying and hearing the voiceover of his dating app, essentially, his dating service. And talking about, you know, I'm a religious guy, I like to work out, blah, blah. It went from a ridiculously graphic thing from this guy who clearly has issues to the complete opposite of those issues, but still somebody who's dealing with issues. We get to know those characters and everybody in between in the first 10 minutes of this movie. It's some of the best writing ever done in a movie, those first 15 minutes of this movie. And that, you know, I guess you could say the first 20, 25 minutes, because if you include the introduction, the prologue, whatever it is.
Yeah, but I think the prologue's so important to this movie, though, because it, like you said, this entire movie is this meditation on the idea of coincidence versus, like, interconnectality, and just, like, how interconnected humans are with each other. And the fact that we get these three stories with, like, you know, the Greenberry Hill murder and the scuba diver and the suicide, it's so interesting to just see these thought experiments, essentially, is how PTA is starting this movie, especially when you get into, like, the suicide of, like, is the suicide, is it murder, like, what's going on with this, and the interconnectedness of all these characters. It's really, like you said, PTA is just presenting his thesis here of we are all connected in a way where coincidence is just our excuse for not understanding that those connections that we have with people. And the fact that we have all of these characters who are in this chain of connections with each other and are connected that way, it makes each and every one of them so compelling, because we're seeing how these small things that each of them are doing are impacting the lives of everyone else around them.
Yeah. And everybody is being impacted. I mean, you think about, I mean, and we'll talk about it, but the interview that Frank T.J. Mackey is doing, we'll talk about the one shot, which I think is, like, perfection. But the interview that he's doing, where the whole time the reporter is just letting him lie, and then she finally challenges him. And that's the moment you realize how messed up this guy really is. And that old man dying, who you kind of know is a pain in the ass or whatever, now you realize how bad of a person he really is. Mm-hmm. And you realize how bad it is funny how just that one conversation that Jason Robards isn't even in reveals so much about Jason Robards' character and the damage that he did to his son to cause this type of rift between the two of them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is, like, this setup, because we're focused so much on these characters over this 24-hour span, you can lose a lot in character for this. But the film is just written in a way where you learn everything you need to at the exact precise moment where you need to further understand each of them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And like Frank T.J. Mackey, I see, and this is where like Tom Cruise not winning the Oscar for this is just so egregious. Personally, this is one of my favorite performances in anything ever. Depth of Frank T.J. Mackey is crazy because this is an easy one-note character if you wanted to. Nobody's going to get bored watching him run around and, you know, screaming the lines that he's screaming that I'm not going to repeat on this podcast. But screaming those lines and, like, you know, he's at the seminar for these, like, dweeby men and, like, what is he going to do and blah, blah. And it's like, and then at the end to see him having that breakdown with his father, I'm not going to cry for you. And just to see Cruise's breakdown in that moment. This is a movie with, John, you had said you believed it was six. There's actually eight, I believe, main characters. It's Stanley, Tom, Frank T.J. Mackey, Jimmy Gator, Phil Parma's kind of one, kind of not, Donnie Smith, Linda Partridge, Jim Curring, Earl Partridge, and then Claudia Wilson Gator. That's eight if you don't count Phil Parma, which I personally do count Phil Parma because I think he goes through such a journey himself as well, which is Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. So you could say there's nine characters. You get that amount of depth from Tom Cruise's character in this movie. There's movies where the protagonist of the movie is in every scene and doesn't even come close to the depth of Frank T.J. Mackey in this movie. That's where, like, the expertise here, and what always gets me with this movie is there's not a single storyline that I sit down and I'm like, oh God, they're cutting back to this one now. Like, oh, why are you doing that? Because it catches you at the most important moments. Like, I always think with Jimmy Gator and Stanley, the fact that they're happening at the same time in the same place makes them more compelling because we're getting some of the scenes at that show could be very boring.
Yeah,
but we're getting some of those scenes from Stanley's point of view and the other parts from Jimmy's point of view. And they're two completely different point of views. And then on top of that, we got the father, who is probably the biggest piece of shit in this movie. And we have all three of their perspectives around this one thing that if you just had it from the point of view of one character could get really stale really, really quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's just this great use of perspective to show this, and the contrast in perspective that we get from these characters is fantastic because, like you said, Jimmy Gator and Stanley, they're in these different things where, like, Stanley is feeling he is being pigeonholed into this very specific role that he is going to have to live to his entire life, and we're seeing this story play out for the previous Stanley. And we're like, yeah, you don't want that. That seems miserable. And then you have Jimmy Gator, who's been doing this his entire life. He's in the twilight of his career. He's dying of cancer. And he's incredibly estranged from his daughter. Mm-hmm. And he's just living with all this regret and trying to figure that out. And we see the two of them interacting in a way where neither of those stories are at the forefront, but they still just drive the way you interpret all of these scenes together.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think with the heart, since this is just such like a sloppy meditation on life, right? Like that's like really all this is.
Yeah.
I do think that the one thing at the end of this movie that you realize is everybody except for Philip Baker Hall ultimately gets what they wanted or needed in this movie. Mm-hmm. Philip Baker Hall is the only one who doesn't get it, Jimmy Gator. And that's all, it's like, kind of like this, like, he didn't, like, he never faced the facts. And now he has to live with this forever, whereas everybody else is starting to kind of be able to come to terms with everything. I mean, this whole movie with Donnie Smith, think about how quiz kid Donnie Smith is so mentally messed up that he wants to get braces because he thinks that that'll make a gay bartender like him. We don't even know if the bartender's gay, but that's what he thinks. That's going to make the bartender love him because he's going to get oral surgery when his teeth are perfectly straight. I love that scene with Alfred Molina. Your teeth, you don't need braces. You don't need braces, Donnie. Like, you don't need braces. I love that. But at the end of the movie, what happens? He gets hit in the face with a frog, falls on his face, and guess what? Now he needs the braces. What keeps recurring throughout this, and I do not know the Bible well, so I'm not going to pretend I do, but Exodus 8:2 is what keeps popping up throughout this whole thing. And if you look that up, if you refuse to let them go, I will send a plague of frogs on your whole country. I don't know what that's in reference to. I believe it's Moses or something, you know.
It is. But Exodus is the chapter of the Bible that's discussing, you know, the plight of the Jewish people in Egypt and their suffering under the Pharaoh and things like that.
But what it ultimately feels like too is like, okay, the suffering under the Pharaoh, and if you don't let them go, I'm going to send a plague of frogs. It's almost like all of these people are suffering. Every character in this is like PTA's interpretation is everybody in this movie is suffering, and they're all at their points where they cannot get through this. They don't know where to turn. They don't know what to do. And the frogs come and more actually send them in the direction. It's almost like these people couldn't go. If you're taking the literal here, if you refuse to let my people go, I'll send a plague of frogs. It's almost like the regret and the past will not let these people go. But the frogs come in and they do. And it allows, it's like biblical and it's not. And it's just PTA taking a huge chance. I mean, I think this is one of the most ambitious films ever made in the history of time, because it's not some grand epic. It's just people, and it has frogs, and it has a scene where every character sings the same song and like all of that stuff. But if you think about it, once the frogs come, Melora Waters and her mother, they get back together. Officer Jim gets to be the hero after a day where he had a bad day. Donnie's going to get his braces. Stanley, at a point where he is giving up, looking out the window and just saying, this happens. This is a thing that happens. It's almost like he's refound his wonder in the world. And now he's able to confront his father and know who he is. That's when Tom Cruise is breaking down on his father's bed, and Phil Parma, almost, why is it raining frogs? This is when Julianne Moore gets saved. And all of these things happen when this moment happens. And I just think it's such an interesting way to bring this in. I mean, it's a breaking point for a lot of people in the movie. I mean, some people are going to sit down, watch this movie, be like, holy shit, I just watched 2 hours and 40 minutes and now it's raining frogs. Like, what the hell? But I do think that this is just PTA's way of being like, I'm taking this biblical thing, I'm putting a spin on it, and I'm making it as this is the freeing experience for all of these characters that we just spent so much time with. Because after that moment, we don't see Philip Baker Hall again, but we see all the other characters, and we see that every one of them is in a better place than they were prior to that moment.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely a bizarre scene when you're watching this for the first time. I had my roommate come in like partway through the movie, and then they're like, why is it raining frogs? And it's like, doesn't matter. Yeah. It's just raining frogs. Like, it's feel, and that's a weird thing to say about a movie, because at the same time, it's this bizarre thing. It's this thing that people talk about with Magnolia, but there's no point in explaining the context when they haven't watched the entire film. It's like, no, this makes sense given what's going on. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It's that point of, it's tension relieving, right? It's such an absurd moment that everyone's tension can just be released at that time, and they can let go of everything that's holding them back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they do. And everybody comes out of this better. You know, they learn something, they grow in some way. And in Shortcuts, which was the inspiration for this movie, so Robert Altman's Shortcuts, it's an earthquake that happens that kind of unites all the characters. Like, you know, it happens to all the characters at the same time. In this one, it's raining frogs. You could sit there and say, this is ridiculous, whatever. What I do love about it, though, is that everybody's just like, why is this happening? It's, you know, this is a very realistic movie until that moment. However, I do think that moment is, I love that moment. I know for some people it is just such a turn up, but I love that moment. And I think it's an incredible, it's just, again, the ambition to sit down. And this was New Line Cinema saying to Paul Thomas Anderson, Boogie Nights was just one of the biggest hits we've ever had. Go make whatever the hell you want. And he showed them what a director will do when you tell them, go make whatever the hell you want. Because he just made this.
Yeah, I mean, and it's fantastic. And that's just what it comes down to, is like Paul Thomas Anderson can make a very good film, always. Yeah.
Well, and so I wanted to bring this up. I know I'd mentioned this earlier, but John, do you know about Orlando Jones in this movie?
I do not.
So Orlando Jones plays the Worm, right? We see him in a jacket, one scene. The Worm was meant to be the 10th character, essentially, in this movie, a main character. And the worm was the one who was kind of keeping all of them together. You know, he's the one mm-hmm. who they're all looking for him because of, you know, whatever he's doing and the cop and whatever, blah, blah, blah. And after the movie was filmed and they had the worm stuff in there, it was about 4 hours long. So PTA had to call Orlando Jones and say, good job, man. You gave a great performance. I have to cut the whole thing from the movie. Orlando Jones is still credited in this movie, despite the fact that he is not actually seen in the entire movie because they had to cut his entire part from the whole thing. So the worm was meant to be an actual character rather than just like the rap. It's crazy, though, that it still works without him. However, he was supposed to be an actual character.
That's really interesting because I was wondering that because I was like on the IMDb page. I'm like, Orlando Jones. I haven't seen Orlando Jones in this movie at all. And that makes a lot of sense. Interesting that they kept the credit, but I guess that, I mean, you do when someone puts in.
I mean, yeah, he was too big of a name. I mean, you think this was 1999. I mean, Orlando Jones, you know, coming off of what Office Space was the same year. And, you know, he had been in some stuff. Like this was when Orlando Jones was a little bit more popular. So they really didn't have a choice, but to keep him in. It's just crazy.
It's really interesting, but I also understand like having to cut down the movie. Like that's the thing, right? Like, yes, PTA is given like essentially carte blanche from New Line Cinema here, but within reason, right?
Yeah, exactly. You can't have a 4 hour. Can't have a 4 hour movie, but
I mean, you could. But
you could. What did you think about the Wise Up scene, John?
I mean, it's just one of those prolific scenes. It's really what it comes down to, like. I don't know. I don't know what there is to say about that scene that hasn't already been said about that scene.
Yeah. It's another one of those that's just so polarizing. But what's funny to me is like every movie you watch that has multiple characters, even if it's three characters, when you're getting to a climax, they'll always have like the intercuts between all the characters and they're playing some score, some song or whatever. It's funny that that's okay. But having the characters actually sing their own score to this moment isn't okay. I just think that's fascinating. But I think another one, like it's another really good moment and it's all the characters like in their deepest of thoughts because every one of them is at their breaking point. I mean, this is the song that sets up the climax for the movie, which is everybody hitting rock bottom and then finding their way out.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know. Does it seem weird? Yeah, it's weird. It's different, but I think that's why it's good too, right? Like, it again is just showing that interconnectivity between these characters. That despite the fact that they're not interacting with each other directly, they are indirectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because there's some characters who never actually meet or do anything or whatever, but they impact each other. I mean, they just. They everybody kind of impacts everybody in this movie. And I think that's what's good. But yeah, only had three Oscar nominations. I mean, 99 was a great year for movies.
It doesn't matter.
No, I agree. Hey, I have American Beauty as my number two. So like, you know, that's the same year. But I mean, this was nominated for original screenplay, Tom Cruise, and best song. And it's funny. Yeah. No Julianne Moore, who gives a phenomenal performance. No Philip, John C. Reilly. I mean, John C. Reilly is amazing. Melora Waters, for as obnoxious as she might seem in this movie, sure does play a good drug addict. I'll just say that.
Who does an awful lot of cocaine.
A lot of cocaine. Yeah. There's a reason she's screaming every time she's talking. But with Melora Waters, this movie was actually started with that character. It was that character and it was the cop. Those were the two characters that PTA then built this entire story around. And in case you couldn't tell from PTA's filmography, he does have issues with his father. In case you just can't tell from, I don't know, anything he's ever made. Yeah, you would never caught that, right? So it went from Melora Waters and John C. Reilly, and it built out from there. And the John C. Reilly stuff was meant to be filmed like it was Cops. And like, there's so many fascinating elements to Magnolia. And again, it's why I go back. I think it's one of the most ambitious films ever made. 1999. 3 hours, American film, with all these A-list stars. I mean, how many Oscar winners or Oscar nominees are in this movie? Every single one of them who's a main character, with the exception of Melora Waters and the kid who plays Stanley, is an Oscar winner or an Oscar nominee.
Yeah.
And you make this 3-hour movie where it's just going through the hardships of life. The thing I compare it the most to is what The Leftovers is. Like when The Leftovers became a TV show, that is what this is the closest to. It's so hard to explain why I love Magnolia, but it's the pacing, it's the acting, it's the ambition. And it's just, man, every time I watch it, it makes me feel Tom Cruise. For anybody who doesn't think Tom Cruise can act and he's just an action star, this is one of the all-time great performances ever. And I honestly couldn't believe it when I watched this movie for the first time. I didn't know about this movie. Like in 1999, I was too young to really follow the Oscars or anything like that. And I didn't know that Tom Cruise had been nominated for an Oscar, had won the Golden Globe for this. I remember watching it, and as it was over, I was like, oh my God. Like, did he win for that? And then I look up, it was Michael Caine. And again, like I said, everybody just go look up the number one review over on for the Cider House Rules and just think about how frustrated that person was watching the movie and understand that I was just frustrated. So anyway, it's the second most liked
review. Oh, sorry.
Anyway, sorry. John, I didn't watch anything this week. So what was the best movie you watched this week?
I watched 2 4-star movies this week, in my opinion. I finally got around to Tom Ford's Nocturnal Animals, which, man, what a interesting way to tell a story.
Dark movie.
Very dark movie. My Lord, that is a very dark movie. Oh, I don't know what I was expecting. I was expecting dark, but I don't think I was expecting that dark. But it's a phenomenal film. Jake Gyllenhaal is incredible in it.
One of my favorite scores of all time.
Yeah, it's incredible, and it's devastating. I just kept watching devastating movies this week. But the best of the best was the other PTA movie I ended up watching this week. I finally have watched every single PTA movie. It took me long enough. But I watched Punch Drunk Love this week. And boy, oh boy, that movie is underrated.
It's a very underrated movie. Adam Sandler is hilarious in that. Philip Seymour Hoffman's role, it's so small, but it's so good.
It's so good. It's just iconic. Like that entire scene at like the furniture warehouse is so incredible. It's hilarious. It's an awkward movie. It's uncomfortable. You don't feel like you should be enjoying it, but every aspect of it was fantastic. It's unlike any other movie PTA's ever made. And it's like PTA kind of like going into like a Lynchian territory with the way that Barry is in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so wonderful because of it.
Well, it's probably the most important movie to him actually making There Will Be Blood, because PTA was always making these huge like ensemble cast movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even Hard Eight is kind of an ensemble.
A pretty big ensemble cast movie still.
Yeah. Boogie Nights, Magnolia. Like he was making ensemble, ensemble, ensemble. And Punch Drunk Love was really his first initiation into this. And it works. I mean, Punch Drunk Love is a fun one. I haven't seen that in years, but I do remember enjoying it quite a bit.
It's a good watch. It's not PTA's best, but it's a PTA film. Like there's not a single PTA, like maybe Hard Eight is like a 3.5. But like that's PTA. His filmography is just incredible.
Yeah, I'd have to look up so I could argue which PTA movie I don't like. I don't really like Inherent Vice. That's the only one though. Everything
else, Inherent Vice might be the lowest.
Is the only one that I do not like by him, really at all. But anyway, speaking of good watches, John, let's talk about The Vitch.
Yes, The Vitch. I remember when this movie came out back in 2015. This was billed as like the scariest horror movie of all time. Do I think it's the scariest horror movie of all time? No. But damn if this movie is not unsettling. It sets the stakes right early on in the film, and it doesn't let up for the entire hour and a half it runs. It's a short film. It's a sweet film. It's filled with spectacular performances. My God, the acting in this movie is just insanely good. And the way that Eggers is able to build this story in a way where you don't know who is doing this to this family, it's phenomenal and engaging. And this is really the point where I think horror movies turned in the last decade. The Witch is just that turning point where, yes, it's not the first like slow burn atmospheric horror movie of the decade, but it is the point where people realize, oh, this is where we're going.
It was the year before, from what I think. Let me just do a quick.
Pretty sure it was the year before with like It Follows is where it started.
And The Babadook. They both came out in 2014, but It Follows and The Babadook, those directors haven't necessarily taken off, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, David Robert Mitchell did Under the Silver Lake, and that's really it. I don't even know who directed The Babadook. That's a great question for me.
Australian
person? Type one thing wrong on Letterboxd, it completely messes up. Jennifer Kent. Jennifer Kent really hasn't done anything since. So, but with The Witch, it was building off of those. And as weird as it is, this was a more accessible movie. And here's why. I think this was more accessible because it wasn't set during modern times. It follows. I think there's an expectation when you sit down and make like a slasher movie involving teenagers. That's tough to do. With The Babadook, it's a monster movie kind of thing. That's hard to do. But with The Witch, you set it in this time period that people like, you know, that people are already kind of like, man, people were dying at like 12 during that time, you know, play the Oregon Trail and, you know, you're going to die of dysentery at some point. Like, that's what this movie is. And I feel like that helped it because the first time I saw this, I was very disappointed in this movie. I really was. Because of what you just said, it was billed as this great horror, this, that, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I remember like, and by very disappointed, I mean, I thought this was like a 3-star movie. Like I was very disappointed. Yeah. I thought it was going to be better. You know, like The Lighthouse lived up to my expectations. The Northman lived up to my expectations, but this just didn't live up to my expectations. And maybe it was because of how much I loved It Follows. It Follows has been a favorite of mine since the first time I saw it. But on the rewatch, I was like, man, if this wasn't billed the way it was billed, or, you know, advertised the way it was advertised, wow, I would have enjoyed this so much more. Because really the problem with it is after that initial scene of the baby being stolen, it's not that scary from there on. It's loud. There's some creepy moments. The part where the son dies is very creepy. But it's not like horror. It's kind of like the Blair Witch kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it almost felt like to me that this was my Blair Witch for a second, you know, where like when people in the 90s heard all the scariest movie of all time, they said, I'm watching, like, that was stupid. I hated that.
Yeah.
Not that I hated this, but it just didn't hit me that way. On this rewatch, I loved it. Also, I know he's not the best looking guy in the world, but can we give Ralph Ineson more movies? Like, can we give him more roles? Because I know he's not the best looking guy. I know he's not an A-lister by any means. And I know he's in the Harry Potters and the Guardians movies and Star Wars, but like, he's not playing meaty roles in those movies. This guy can act. He can act. Yeah. He can act. He can act. And really, the first thing that I remember him from was in Game of Thrones, where he's the one who ultimately convinces Theon to take over Winterfell and knock him on the head. And it was a good speech. And then we never see him again. Such a great actor. He's phenomenal in this. And actually, Kate Dickie also, understand, like, not the best looking actress, not an A-lister, but can we get Kate Dickie more? Because she's also, Lady Aaron.
Yes. Game of Thrones.
She's fantastic in that too. Like, get these people some roles. Obviously, it was always going to be easier for Anya Taylor-Joy to come out of this getting roles because she is incredibly good looking and she is an A-lister as far as I'm concerned. But still, would be nice to see Kate Dickie and Ralph Ineson, after these performances, get a little more credit.
I mean, both of them were in The Green Knight this last year. Like, but again, it's in bit roles, right? They're on the side.
Yeah, they're not
And despite the fact that they give such phenomenal performances in this movie, like, you feel for this family this entire time because they're going through trauma. Despite the mother's terrible treatment of Thomas in the entire movie, like, it's understandable why she's acting like this. She's upset with her husband who has relocated them to a place where it's like, oh yeah, you're just gonna die out here. She has lost her child to who knows what because another child wasn't paying close enough attention to her. And like, it's so devastating. It's understandable what's happening, and the way that Eggers sets up the film is there's this the one of the most phenomenal scenes in this is where they're at the river and the brother's washing his clothes and like, you know, perving on his sister and stuff. And Anya Taylor-Joy goes into her, but I'm the Witch of the Woods speech. And it's terrifying. And it's just this beautiful moment where you're like, wait, but is she?
Does she know? Is there something in her? Like, yeah.
Like, is she the witch? And of course we get to the conclusion of the film and we find out, no, she is not quite a witch yet. But there's this belief that she's the one who is, you know, behind everything that's happening. Despite the fact that there are two very creepy twins running around saying they're talking to a goat.
Which and they are. They are actually talking to Black Phillip, like the whole movie.
Yeah, the entire movie. And it turns out Black Phillip is the devil. So, you know, it's crazy how Eggers is able to build this amount of mistrust where it's like, you're just not sure who is responsible for the misfortunes this family is going on. Is it the father for relocating them there in the first place and like believing that they don't have to be part of this colony and that they can do it themselves? Is it Thomason? Is she a witch? Is it the twins who are like talking to this devil goat? Is it the mother? Maybe she's the one behind it all. She seems on the verge of like being pretty crazy. She might be doing this all herself. But in the end, there's a beautiful detail Eggers puts on this film. And I don't know if you got this. The scene where the father and the son are looking at the corn. How much attention did you pay attention to the corn?
Probably like a 2 out of 100.
So not enough to notice that there's ergot on the corn.
There's what?
There's ergot. It's a mold that grows on corn that is a hallucinogen.
Ah, that's fun.
So the fact of the matter is like everything is put in this place where you're not sure what's actually happening in this film. And yes, we've seen this the child get kidnapped and then turned into butter. Like, that's a disturbing scene. That is an absolutely disturbing scene. To see a baby get implied, turn into butter, and then smeared all over a witch's body. Terrifying. And then you see the witch again later. As she's young and attractive, just luring in the boy. It's visceral. It's haunting. And it just makes you... You're so tense the entire movie because you're just waiting for the dam to break.
Yeah, you are. And I think it's because of that opening witch scene. Like, and that's where like the timing works on this because we get them like there's five characters in this movie. I mean, it's the family. Like that's our six, I guess, because there's the twins. But it's like six characters and the witch. That's all that's really in this movie. There's no other
character. Black Phillip, arguably a very important character.
Well, Black Phillip's a very important character, but Black Phillip's not like really like a character throughout. Yeah. Like you don't really know. It's just a goat. I'm saying like this movie could have easily had an act one where they're in the town and they get in trouble and they do this and they do that. And then they get ostracized. Then where instead it's just like, here's the speech. We don't need you. We're leaving. You see the gates close behind them. And now they're on their own in the 1630s in America where nothing was. But they're going to figure it out. They're a family. They're going to do it. Whatever. Yeah, I'm sure that's going to work out just fine. They always talk about going back to the community, but they never actually go back to the community, which is, I think, a huge point to be made in this movie. But I really, really, really just the decision to not have any other characters come in, to not have any – like because that's the mistake a lot of movies like this would make, right? Yeah. Like – here's the family and all. Here comes the nice old passerby who's going to help him out. And then there's your bad guy, by the way. Like, this movie doesn't do that. It just allows it to be these people and their faith and their religion and everything that they believe in and the fact that that is going to be what carries them through this. I talked about this when we talked about The Exorcist. This really is like one of my favorite genres of horror. Like, I love the religious genre of horror because whether you're religious or not, you know, it's the whole thing – it's the whole thing in The Usual Suspects. I don't believe in the devil, but I'm scared of him. Like, it's that thing. Whether you're religious or not, you don't want to be the one who gets Reagan'd. You know what I mean? Like, you're not really trying to be possessed by the devil, just in case he's there. You don't want to be Rosemary's Baby. And you don't want to have this happen where they can't fathom what's happening. They're so religious. They care so much. Why is this happening to them? And it is funny that in a lot of these movies, they generally have it, at least in the smart ones, in the good ones, they generally have it where it is a good family, law-abiding, religious, who is being the most affected by this, or at least pure in some way. And I think that's what makes it more disturbing. We're seeing this family that has been ostracized, but is going to be able to do this together and get through this. And we see them being preyed upon, despite the fact that they are doing everything they think is correct in through their religion. And we see that, you know, Exorcist, Rosemary's Baby, they don't really necessarily, they're not necessarily religious, but they're not doing anything wrong. And I think that always makes it a little bit more compelling and a little bit more difficult to watch when these people start going through the negative aspects of things, because what did they do? Why? It's the randomness of the whole thing. And not for nothing, on Thomason feels a little too excited to be a part of this at the end. Good for her. She's like, ooh, I'm a witch now. But, you know, is what it is, I guess. I guess she can't really
support it, right? You know what? With how she was treated over the course of this movie, she deserves it. You know, like, all power to her. Like, everyone thought she was a witch anyways. Might as well be one.
Yeah.
She gets to live deliciously. Who doesn't want to live deliciously?
Yeah. Yeah. She's floating. I mean, she's taller than a tree at the end of this movie. So, you know, there's always that.
Exactly. Which also gives us one of the great, like, Eggers shots, the silent laughter shot that Eggers takes. Mm-hmm. It's phenomenal. It's a great way to close this film of just Thomason's just laughing, cackling, and she's floating up into the tree. It's fantastic. And it does feel like a good for her moment, but in the way where it's like, she's accepting the world that she has been forced into. It's this big, like, it's this thought process on it. I think the themes that Eggers is putting out in this movie, this idea of like, are we born sinners, and like, are we irredeemable as a human kind, as always? And it's also, if you look at it, like, there is this like underlying feminist approach to it, and especially with it's exasperated during Puritan times, but women are get blamed for a lot of stuff that happens.
Yeah.
And that's what we're seeing here, is that because Thomason is the one that happens to be there when Sam's kidnapped, like, yes, okay, she should probably be blamed for that one. Fair point. But it's like the cup goes missing, and Thomason's clearly the person who hid it. And like the thought process of, oh no, there's no way that this one thing we have that is worth anything was sold by my husband so we could keep surviving. Like, it's those little things, and it's that build up there. And it's these themes that really anchor this movie together, because Eggers puts them in the forefront, but then doesn't fully address them and lets you come to conclusions about them.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's really just like the lack of trust the mother has in her after losing the one child, because of how much of an impact it has on the mother. That's where all this starts to come in. And like, I like that Thomason is ultimately like becoming a witch at the end and everything like that. But at the same point, it's like, you know, I also kind of like the idea that she wasn't really doing anything bad or manipulating or anything. And we see the movie from her eyes, because realistically she is our protagonist, even though we do get scenes with Jonas and William, you know, by themselves, but Thomason is our protagonist, like, the whole movie. So I don't know. I appreciate that we don't really know, or that she's not bad. And then she just ultimately gets there. And like, what else is she going to do anyway? You know, I mean, now she's a witch, and to set it during this time period, and make her a witch at the end, and like kind of like just be like, yeah, witches were real back then. Like, that was a serious concern people had back in the day, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes you think, like, was everything in this film orchestrated by Black Phillip in order to get Thomason?
That's what it feels like.
Right? And it's like, is this coincidental? Is this the fact that, like, okay, there happens to be a baby here. Yeah, we're going to steal that baby and turn it into baby butter for us. Like, whatever, that seems excusable. Nothing else happens on the farm until Jonas goes out into the forest and gets, you know, abducted by a witch. So it's framed in a way where it's like, is this coincidental or is this orchestrated? And that's kind of the beauty of it, because again, it's Eggers just posing questions that he is willing to let the audience be smart enough to ponder themselves.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the good part about, well, that's what makes good horror, is when you're not just saying, no, this is what it is. This is what it, like, let people think. Here's my question to you, though. Why do you think Robert Eggers ultimately caught on? Now, and by this, I mean, oh, there's a lot of directors who will make one really good horror movie, and it'll be like an okay, moderate success. And then, you know, they'll put something out not too long after that. And then, you know, you never really hear from them again. Why do you think that Eggers was able to kind of overcome all of this? You know, that goes on with a lot of one horror directors. It was 4 years before The Lighthouse came out. And The Lighthouse isn't really a horror movie. It's a weird movie, but it's not really a horror movie. And then 3 years after that, you have The Northman, which comes out. Mm-hmm. You only made three movies in 7 years. But why do you think that, like, Robert Eggers has caught on in a way that David Robert Mitchell hasn't, or Jennifer Kent? Like, what do you think that is?
I think there are a few things that contribute to it. And it's impossible to talk about Eggers and not mention the influence that A24 as a distribution company has in the success of these directors like Eggers, like Ari Aster, who create these atmospheric horror movies and have a means to have them distributed. We're just in a time period where people appreciate the little guy so much more than the big guy.
Yeah.
And I think that really helps where it also helps. I mean, A24 is a distribution company. They've produced very few movies. They finally got into the production side of things, but they're just distributors. They move movies around. And the fact that A24 kind of set this name for themselves with these slow burn atmospheric horror films, it just had this, it was just this grouping of films that had people able to glom onto them, right? And I think what Eggers really does is, again, it's Eggers trusts his audience, which is the mistake that a lot of these horror directors don't do. And even with, like, The Lighthouse, if we're even just looking at The Lighthouse, like, he's able to get some pretty big names to be the two people in that movie. So I think he just built this movie in a way where it showed that he had this vision. He showed that he respected his audiences and that he had these stories to tell. And that's why, I mean, The Lighthouse is way up. We're going to talk about that in several weeks from now still, where it falls in my top 100. But he just has this style to him that really works in the time period. And he really benefited from, you know, Hereditary coming out shortly after. He benefited from, like, Get Out coming out. And he just benefited from not being the first of these slow atmospheric horror movies, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think that does help. And, you know, when you're not the first, sometimes if you're the first, that's the best. Like, if you're Blair Witch, that was great, but not for nothing. The Paranormal series was much more successful than Blair Witch after the first Blair Witch. The Paranormal series just took off. It's what are people hungry for? Now, I don't know. I mean, did The Witch make a lot of money? It had to have made a lot on its budget, right? Like, I don't know if it actually
was. So. I don't know for sure.
Let me look. Let me see if I type it in as The Witch, if it'll actually take it. Oh, it does. Yeah, John, it's right there. Budget was $4 million. It made $40 million. So it made 10 times its budget. And you got to figure with P&A and all that stuff. I mean, it probably made close to 7 times its budget. That's a good turnaround on a movie, especially you're working with these kind of no-namers in Ralph Ineson and Kate Dickey and Anya Taylor-Joy at the time. And then you turn around and then you make a movie that's just Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson, who are both very famous and both in very different spheres. And then you turn around and you make a movie with Skarsgård and Anya Taylor-Joy and Ethan Hawke and Nicole Kidman. And, like, it's funny to see the growth there. For sure. One thing that I always find – one thing that I find funny about The Witch, and I have to bring it up just because, like, I have, like, a bit of a personal connection. So I always look for the name and I just think it's funny when it happens. But one of the main producers on this movie was Chris Columbus. Who up until this point had done nothing but comedies and, like, family movies and the Harry Potters and Percy Jackson and the Olympians and Night at the Museum, I Love You, Beth Cooper, Gremlins, Pixels. And somehow this caught his attention. I just think that that's very interesting because then he also went on to produce The Lighthouse, but then didn't produce The Northman. So I just think it's interesting. Like, what is it that caught his attention? Now, I know also his daughter produced this movie and The Lighthouse as well. But I just find it interesting that, like, so against type, obviously a guy who is very influential in Hollywood, whether you like his new movies or not, he's definitely stayed relevant and his name means a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he puts money behind The Witch of all things. Yeah. Like, it's like he made Pixels, I think, the next year or the same year. Like, the same year he does Pixels.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so weird to me. And, like, maybe that also helps Eggers in this situation because he did have the backing of one of the people who's probably the most successful, one of the most successful Hollywood people out there.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Columbus is, like, he's known for a lot. And he has a lot of connections to a lot of very prolific people in the Hollywood sphere. Like, it's, you know what they say, right? Like, it's just who you know.
Yeah. And I wonder how, of all people, Robert Eggers ended up in that situation. Like, I would love to know where Robert Eggers came from to get this attention here, to get the attention of somebody who was making Harry Potters and movies like that, to turn around and make this small, low-budget movie and then stick with him for The Lighthouse. I just, you know, what party did Robert Eggers walk into?
The right one, apparently.
Apparently. But yeah, I think that's interesting. And maybe that has helped him a little bit too, that, you know, if you go and you look at a movie like It Follows doesn't have a name like that attached to it, you know, and maybe that is the reason why Robert Eggers is just able to kind of keep going. That's a compliment too, because I mean, his style, everything is ridiculous. I mean, The Northman is actually my favorite one out of his three movies. And that's saying a lot because I love his three movies. Now that I've watched this one again, I know I love his three movies, but The Northman's my favorite one. I thought The Northman was just freaking awesome. His style and everything is just great. But I'm curious to see where he's going to keep going because he's getting less horror, but he's staying in like these kind of like adult, he's almost like becoming Guillermo del Toro. He's making like adult folklore instead of adult fairy tales. Like it's different, but it's adult folklore.
Yeah. I mean, that's the best way to put it, right? Like he's just, I mean, the subtitle for this movie is a New York or a New England folktale.
Yeah.
And The Lighthouse is definitely a folktale when you get into it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it just seems to be what he is attracted to are these folk stories and building on those. And yeah. I don't know. He had the backing of Chris Columbus for this. I think this movie was also much more well marketed than the slow burn movies that came out the year before.
For sure.
Because I remember.
I was going to say, I think those movies, though, laid the groundwork that made this easier.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, I remember the marketing for The Witch back in 2015. Like, it was low-key, but for those who were, like, in tune with the cinema world, like, you had heard about this movie at that time.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I remember seeing this in the Lemley in North Hollywood, right around the corner from my apartment. Like I just remember, whoop, walked right over, watched it, turned around, walked out. Like small movie theater, not like a huge chain, but yeah, it's an interesting movie. I'm very excited to see what Eggers is going to continue to do. Although he does feel like he is going the PTA Stanley Kubrick route of like, I'm going to take my time. I'm going to make these movies and take my time making these movies. And that's fine. It's always a bummer when it's a couple years in between and you really look forward, but you know, as long as he keeps
the turnaround between The Lighthouse and The Northman wasn't that long. It was 3 years.
Three years.
COVID happened in between.
I was going to say, but COVID happened. So really, it felt like it was 10 years. So
yeah, you know,
that doesn't help. But yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of The Witch. I didn't think I was coming into this. I was actually, maybe that actually helped its rating, was just kind of caught me by surprise a little bit.
That's what you need sometimes. That's why it's so important to revisit movies.
It is. It really is. It's at least ones that are like at least decent. You don't need to revisit ones that you absolutely hate. Well, do you have anything else you want to say about this movie?
Nope.
Okay. Next week, we are going full sci-fi. we're talking about Arrival from 2016, which is John's movie. And for me, I had 2001 A Space Odyssey. John has that higher. So instead, we're going to be talking about Interstellar, which I think is our generation's space odyssey. And people can shoot me if they want for that. But I really do believe that. And I can't wait to talk about that movie, because even though it didn't make my top 100, there was definitely an iteration where Interstellar was in it. Can't wait to rewatch it, even if Christopher Nolan has pissed me off relentlessly since then. But Interstellar and Arrival, two of, I think, the best science fiction movies we've seen in the last decade. Very excited to sit down and talk about those. Not sure what day we'll be doing this yet. You know, been having some personal stuff, so we're trying to figure all that out. But just stay tuned. Thank you all for listening. Thanks for being there. John, always a pleasure. And we'll see everybody next week. That's our number 26. We're almost into the top 25, so we'll see everybody next week.